This is hell.
Some believe the imperialist world economy is dead, done, never to be heard from again. Others see it still thriving, but in a new, changed form. Here to help us understand what is really happening within the world economy, sociologist Intan Suwandi is author of the book Value Chains, The New Economic Imperialism. Welcome to This Is Hell, Intan.
Hello. Intan, thank you for having me.
Thank you for having us, letting us have you on the show. Intan is a frequent contributor to Monthly Review magazine and has written for various publications on the political economy of imperialism, both in English and Indonesian. And real quick, we want to thank listener Calvin for suggesting Intan as a guest. He told us about all the work that you've been writing over at Monthly Review, as well as your new book. So again, thank you, Calvin. Our listeners are the absolute best. You conducted interviews with top managers of two companies in Indonesia, and one of them told you, so all these big developed countries, they have their own protection measures to face globalization. But a country like us, we are so naive, so innocent, so young. We are a developing country. We don't have expertise in making this kind of regulation. Indonesia is in the end becomes the target market. We have to open our market. People come in, some investments come in because our labor is very cheap. But in the end of the day, what happens? They're selling their products here mostly, and we don't have any protections. What protection measures to face globalization do big developed countries have that countries like Indonesia do not? Because I'm certain that people in the United States view the trade deals that we make as at least an attempt to be fair with their trade partners. So what protection measures do these kind of developed economies face when it comes to globalization that these underdeveloped economies do not face that we might not recognize as protective measures?
Well, first of all, the protections that the executive that I interviewed talk about is the one that people often acknowledge, right? That some countries have more protections than others. And it is true. And a lot of deals, the trade deals, are not for the interest of the developing countries or the peripheral countries. They are made they are made to serve the interest of the core countries. There's a lot of examples about these trades, but what is more important is that it's not the protection itself, but also the way global commodity chains are organized or are run in relation to this unequal power globally. So what my work wants to put forward is that the business, the so-called business as usual itself, the business as usual itself is already very unequal. It serves only the interests of global capital, and it is beyond just the talk of political protections or trade protections that we often encounter in daily lives.
You write, interestingly, the opinion expressed that the quote I just read by the interviewee, a representative of capital from the Global South, is predicated on the persistence of the hierarchical world economy, a phenomenon that is recognized by all classes in the South, but which has recently been the subject of a renewed debate among Western scholars, including those on the left. Why do you think that debate is being renewed now? What happened to cause a renewed debate among Western scholars and those on the left? How did the whole world seemingly change to allow for this kind of debate?
I think in terms of the left itself, because the most recent debates were happening because some scholars, including David Harvey, was saying that surplus extraction has been reversed. And the talk of imperialism is no longer relevant or useful. But this renewed debate has a lot of history, right? From the abandonment of talking about imperialism within the left itself, not to mention, of course, the mainstream discourse. But within the left, so some people argued that different arguments. Some people say that imperialism is no longer relevant because, you know, there's a lot of emerging powers coming out, especially China, and they often talks about India or the BRIC countries in general, but also that some people argue that global capital has nothing to do with nation states anymore. So this have encouraged people to think that imperialism has to be abandoned. Recent debates argue back and forth about this, whether, you know, the fact that there are new emerging powers coming in means that, you know, they're the new imperialists, that the old imperialists are obsolete, etc. So that's what's happening. And also all of this conversation is rooted in this new form of globalization, right? People are trying or have been trying to understand what is this globalization that we're encountering now that emerged from the 1970s, and some people call it neoliberal globalization, where global production, production is conducted globally.
If the debate is between whether we are in a post-imperial world or not, how would that make any difference to the most vulnerable, for the poorest, who are the most susceptible to the market? What difference does it make to them if we are living conceptually in a post-imperial world or not? How is the world viewed differently that might have a direct impact and effect on them?
It can happen in several ways. First of all, in terms of how we understand exploitation of labor, that's one thing. The global production, what's happening in global production is that multinationals headquartered in the global north are subcontracting their work to the developing country. And they are benefiting from the exploitation of labor in the periphery. So if you abandoned this idea of imperialism and you say that, for example, extraction of surplus has been reversed, global north does no longer extract surplus from the global south. So of course it will influence our understanding of the exploitation of labor. So what does it mean for the workers in the periphery? Are they no longer exploited? Are you saying that their country is also already like on the same level as the countries in the triad or where multinationals are based? That's one. And of course, this is related to the idea of expropriation or unequal exchange in terms of power relations among nation states. If you're saying that imperialism is no longer relevant, then again, the question is, are you saying that power relation among nations are now or have become equal? Those are two things that we can think about.
So is an argument of the for the end of the imperialist world economy, an argument that supports the idea that we have seen the end of the imperialist world economy, is that an argument then that supports the current regime of globalization and free markets? Doesn't that show that globalization worked and, in fact, it did do the rising of all boats that it promised?
Yeah, that's absolutely implicit in the argument, right? Although, which is ironic because some people on the left put forward that argument, but with the vocabulary of Marxism sometimes, which can be absurd. So yeah, if you say that imperialism is dead and in whatever forms, then of course you say that, well, the global economy, the way it is now, is working. And what is the global economy now? It's the capitalist global economy. So yes, absolutely.
So what is the mistake then that people, and I don't want to pick on any one person, but that people like David Harvey make when they are seemingly all of a sudden apologists for globalization, for free markets? What is the mistake that they are making that leads them to that conclusion? And because I'm wondering if it's a mistake that I might make, that others may make, that it's a simple mistake that you can make logically.
Right. So there's a couple of things. I won't pick up names either, but so one of the common argument that people say, including the left, is that the rate of exploitation in the global north is higher than the rate of exploitation in the global south, and this is only based on the idea, which is like what do you call it? This is really a shallow way of looking at the argument, is that because productivity is higher in the global north. But of course, exploitation is not only it's not only a factor of productivity, but also about wages. So that's one thing. They say because productivity is higher in the global north, then the workers in the global north are still more exploited than the workers in the global south. And another mistake is Indian economist Prabhat Patnaik and Utsav Patnaik, they argue that people who put forward that kind of false arguments, they don't really understand the concept of drain. So when you talk about drain of surplus, right, from the global south to the global north, you're not only talking about flows of surplus, but you're also talking about how you have this exchange without equivalent. That's what drain is about. That you exchange more labor for less, and you don't get anything in return. And that's how the global commodity chains work, in a sense. It is that the global South doesn't get anything in return when they produce commodities for global capital.
You write about this idea that global value chains have ended and the imperial world economy decentralizing it and replacing it with something else. You write that the answer, the response to all of that is, to these questions, is no, despite the seemingly decentralized networks and notwithstanding the existing complexities that characterize global commodity chains, the capital labor relations inherent in these chains are still imperialistic in their configurations. How are those capital labor relations still imperialistic in their configurations? And what explains to you why people don't look at those relations to determine the state of the imperialist world economy?
Right. So that's another thing that I think I should have talked about, is that because this global commodity chains look really decentralized, right? I mean, production is just globally. You got labor from here, you got materials from here. It's such a complicated network that people then argue, because it's decentralized network, then power is also decentralized. But that's not the case, right? Because multinationals with their oligopolistic multinationals still control these chains. These are not chains that are egalitarian, or, you know, some people say this will provide opportunities for developing countries to catch up, etc. But no, these chains are constructed deliberately to maintain control of the multinationals. And they do it in a lot of ways. But before I go there, maybe I should say also that the point is that multinationals are, or as global capital, are taking advantage of wage differentials worldwide, right? And they are searching, they continue to search for countries where they have low unit labor cost. And if you see the data, it's very obvious that that's where production happens. It's where labor unit labor costs are low. So the fact that global capital can freely go around the globe to find low unit labor costs while labor is still contained within borders, right? The workers in the global south are not freely to like go anywhere in the world to work, at least relatively compared to global capital. So this situation alone allows global capital to continue taking advantage or exploit labor in the global south. And the way they do it is really interesting, I think. And a lot of people will see it as well, this is just how it's supposed to be. A lot of bureaucratic components, and especially what scholars now say call systemic rationalization and flexible production. So these are really systematic process of production that allows multinationals to continue their accumulation of profit through exploitation. So I can talk about these forms if you're interested.
Actually, the next question I was going to ask you kind of fits right into that. You write, at issue is the extraction or drain of surplus from the poor countries by the rich countries and or their corporations. I argue that one way to understand the persistent imperialist characteristics of the world economy is through examining the exploitation that occurs in what Karl Marx calls the hidden abode of production, which in the era of global commodity chains is located in the global south. How well hidden is the global south as an abode of production? And is that an intentional hiding by the market?
Yeah. So that's what Marx said, right? Like, to understand exploitation, you have to go to this hidden abode of production where usually, you know, people will say no admittance instead, unless it's for business. And this is where I wanted to go. When production is done globally, it's also more difficult, right, to see this hidden abode. Because especially, say if you buy products and in the U.S., of course, sometimes you don't even have that imagination to think about how this product, or you know, how this iPhone is produced. And again, the conversation about global commodity chains in the mainstream discourse kind of hides that exploitative relations between capital and labor on the global level, because arm's length trades are very hard to trace sometimes. So, you know, when you subcontract something, multinationals will just give the order to their suppliers, and then that's where that's where production happens. And then, you know, you it's sometimes very like complicated networks, and you lose track of things. But so this hidden abode of global production is very hidden sometimes. You know, you get this idea of sweatshops. I mean, you know, recently in the last two decades or so, we've talked a lot about sweatshops, especially in social science, where you know, mostly women workers make shoes or T-shirts. They got paid really low. They have really bad working conditions, and these kind of things have been exposed quite a bit, but it's not always about sweatshops, right? Even in production complexes where it's really far from sweatshops, and the factories that I went to are far from sweatshops, even in the so-called high-tech industries or, you know, so-called capital-intensive instead of labor-intensive industries, what exploitation still happens. So it's not that, you know, they have this, you know, this stereotype of assembly lines with like supervisors behind them, watching them all the time, and you cannot go to the bathroom and etc. It's not only that picture, but also just, you know, regular factories, very clean factories, and mostly machines. And this is also something, mostly machines. There's only several divisions where they're more labor intensive. But even in this kind of factories, exploitation, of course, still happens. Even though it's not only through direct control, it's through different kinds of control. So this is the key components that we should talk about. Is one is control of technology. Multinationals still control the technology of the production. They can dictate to the smallest details how production should happen in their supplier factories or compounds. There's very little technology transfer, and this is like what the globalization cheerleaders are often saying, right? I mean, there's technology transfer; it's good for the developing countries, etc. But that's not what's happening, at least not what I found. Technology is still very controlled. Multinationals control the know-hows, right? The knowledge, the technical knowledge in making their products, even when it's like high tech. So there is no innovation, really, in the supplier side. What they do is that they just receive orders, and yes, to the smallest detail. So control of technology, and also they have a lot of specifications or the way they do business that really show how tight their control is. They can dictate what price they want. And because multinationals are what my participants call, you know, A-list clients, they will do anything to get business from them, and even if that means that they will get lower profit compared to having local customers. Because having multinational clients are really important for their business. It will be some kind of a brand. I mean, you know, if you have multinational clients, then you will get a lot of repeat orders from them and also from other customers. So you kind of like it's a guarantee that you'll do good business. So because of that, multinationals can control everything. They can control your price. They can control your profit margin. They can say, I don't want this material you know, from this kind of supplier, you know, I will introduce you to this supplier, to that really small detail. And that's of course difficult for the suppliers, because it will disrupt their own procedures, their own regulations, etc.
So
those are two examples.
What happens to capitalism then when it's the end of competition, the end of innovation, and there's so many price, profit, and material controls by such a small group of people? What happens to capitalism? What happens to the market, especially from the perspective of those who support capitalism? What happens to the greatness of capitalism when there's no longer the innovation, the competition, and all of these price, profit, and material controls?
Yeah, what I can say is that capitalism is not what you think, or it's not what people perceive, right? I mean, especially in terms of competition, because what happens now is we were having monopoly capitalism, and this is global capital with monopolistic power. And competition still exists in really like limited understanding, right? It's competition among the sometimes there's competition among competition among multinationals themselves, or also competition among suppliers, right? That's the one that's still very very profound, is that suppliers will compete against each other to get multinationals as their clients. So yeah, that's monopoly.
We are speaking with sociologist Intan Suwandi, author of the book Value Chains: The New Economic Imperialism. Intan is a frequent contributor to Monthly Review magazine and has written for various publications on the political economy of imperialism, both in English and Indonesian. This is Intan's first book. She recently received her PhD in sociology from the University of Oregon. You write imperialism has several interrelated aspects, and one of them you mentioned, the one that you're very much concerned with, is global exploitation along with expropriation or appropriation without an equivalent of labor and capitalist production, particularly under the domination of multinational firms emanating primarily from the core of the system. So has our old imperialist world economy then been replaced not by China and India or other growing economies, but by multinational, transnational, even global firms that are located within the nations of the old imperialist economic world order? Is it not that the system has decentralized, but it has been re-centralized in a private corporation rather than a nation-driven way?
So one of my arguments is that no, it's not that. So the fact that, the superpowers are not replaced by the emerging countries doesn't mean that imperialism is just about imperialism in relation to global capital, right? The point is the most powerful components of global capital is the multinationals, is in the form of multinationals and still headquartered in the global north. And this means that they are still related to power relations among nations. The fact that these multinationals are from the U.S. or Western Europe, European countries or Japan mean that, of course, that's a meaning to it, right? It's not that they have such correct characteristics because of nothing. So a lot of power relations among states are still pretty much relevant when we talk about imperialism, especially because of economic processes that happen, right? Because labor is located in these countries that are not in the triad, and capital are located in, or are from the triad, means that extraction of surplus is still going on the way it is. We extract surplus from the global south, and a lot of this value that is captured is not recorded in the GDP of the global south countries, but it's recorded in the GDP of global north countries. And also global north countries are still benefiting from a lot of things like taxes. If you sell the iPhone or, you know, T-shirt in Germany or in the U.S., you get the taxes from the sales, for example. So it's not only in relation to capital, but it's also in relation to states.
Well, that's really fascinating. You write dominant companies, giant multinationals within the chains extract surplus value through various mechanisms of control, both in terms of controlling the production processes of their dependent suppliers and in terms of controlling the labor process of workers employed by these suppliers. And you've touched on some of this already. Their goal here is to make sure that unit labor costs are stably low, even in cases where wage costs are increasing, such as the increase in minimum wage issued through governmental policies. Control mechanisms are instituted to allow global capital to maintain a low unit labor cost by making sure that productivity can be increased.
Uh-huh.
So, but we hear that wages are increasing for those in developing economies. Are labor unit costs, are wages increasing? Does that wage increase have an impact on the imperialist world economy? Are wage increases in developing economies challenging the imperialist world economic order?
So there are maybe two layers to this. First, you can say yes, they affect capital in terms that they make them nervous sometimes, right? That's why whenever there is a wage increase, this is wage alone, wage increase in say in Indonesia or in China. You know, the capital henchmen, I call them the, you know, Asian Development Bank, World Bank, they issue reports right away saying, oh, you know, you guys don't increase your wages or minimum wages. You know, it's really bad for you. And they will have a bunch of justifications with that report. Suggestion, quote unquote, not to increase wages. So that's one thing. I mean, that makes them a little bit nervous. But also, what's most important is that whenever there are wage increases, what they want to make sure is to increase productivity as well. So at the firm level, this is an example. One of my interviewees said, well, you know, because when I was doing the research, there's quite a bit of hike in minimum wages in Indonesia. And I said, well, does this, can you actually ask for like a higher price then from your multinational clients? And they said, no. They will say, yeah, we know that wage increase, but that means you have to increase your productivity as well. And that's what they always do. So they make sure that unit labor cost is still low or stably low by increasing productivity whenever there's a wage increase. And this way of increasing productivity is pretty much controlled as well from by multinationals through this form of flexible production or systemic rationalization. So what they can do, for example, is to demand different forms of flexibility so that they can externalize cost. And this kind of production, flexible production, will often increase control over the labor process, right? To make sure that that workers on the factory floor can have higher productivity. And they can be done in many ways, and a lot of times in ways that are very, that look benign, right? Like enforcing incentive systems. Well, if you work well, then you get more incentives, you get more money, for example. Or they can also impose international standards that will have the mask of good for well-being of workers, for example, while it's actually a way to make sure that workers are productive, and that will keep their unit labor costs low. Now, what happened if there's an increase in unit labor costs? Then, of course, this kind of global commodity chains allows already for global capital to be able to get out of that node, right? Of that specific country, say China, they can get out and move to another country where unit labor cost is lower, and that's what has happened throughout the decades.
Why does that mask that you were just referring to, why does that mask work so well? If you can see beyond that mask, what explains why, let's say, the people who are supposed to be informing us within journalism, why can't they see through that mask?
Oh, yeah, well, I guess there are a lot of possible explanations. But one thing is, of course, ideology. If you're somebody who thinks that exploitation is, there's nothing wrong with exploitation, that, or say if you're a person who thinks that everything is equal, it's a matter of equal exchange, you sell your labor power and you get wages and that's it, like a lot of people believe, then yeah, you probably won't see this as something problematic, right? But also, I don't know. I mean, in terms of international standardizations, they will put forward languages that will make you believe that this is about worker safety, right? This is about workers' well-being. We want to make sure that everything is conducted as the guidelines say. But that's why you need a critical lens, sometimes a radical lens, to see what's beyond that or what's behind that. When you have a workforce that is healthy, and when you have a workforce that goes to work every day, then it means that they are able to increase their productivity, and behind that is the logic of capital, right? To make sure that their workforce can go to work every day, can increase their productivity, etc.
You write, we have seen the formation of a global labor force concentrated in the global south, where there were 541 million global industrial workers in 2010 compared to the 145 million who lived in the global north. Especially in East and Southeast Asia, manufacturers became both or became central both in exports and in production and processes beginning in the 70s and early 80s. Many developing countries, particularly in Southeast Asia, experienced an increase in their manufacturing output shares. So why does that not mean the power has shifted to these countries? After all these countries have the manufacturing jobs that places like the United States don't have anymore. So why doesn't that just state that this means that these countries have now have the power that we no longer have, that the United States lost?
Well, they have the jobs, but that doesn't mean that they prosper. As I explained earlier, first of all, going to having these jobs in the global South, it just means that the workforce is exploited. They are producing surplus value for global capital because of how capitalist production works. And also what happens when jobs go to the global South, it's not just like, oh, they go to the global South. What does that mean for the countries in the global South themselves? That means urbanizations. That's one, right? People are migrating to the urban areas, got absorbed in factories, moving from their villages, and that also create a lot of problems. And that's what happened in China, right? This urban migrant migrant labor. It's a form of super exploitation of these people. Sometimes they're not even paid enough to cover their subsistence. So that's what happened. And it's not only, of course, about labor. It's also about the environment, et cetera, et cetera. And a lot of times, this kind of shift is accompanied also by, changes in regulations, moving away from development from their own for this country's sake to different forms of other things, that really disrupts these countries themselves. So those are just some aspects that we need to think about when we are told that, well, those people get the jobs, but that doesn't mean that they prosper or that that's good for their well-being.
You write a lot about foreign direct investment, and you write, as the size and global reach of multinationals have grown, their strength and ability to accumulate capital have also been enhanced. This has demanded a new structure of management intrinsic to their evolution as multinationals. The patterns of power and their authority can be clearly seen in one of the main processes involved in offshoring: foreign direct investment. Displacing portfolio investment, FDI, became primary after the Second World War, especially in the realm of manufacturing. FDI is a way to penetrate foreign markets. They allow firms from the global north to compete in foreign markets directly rather than through exports only. In addition, they also allow these firms to, quote, enter into the foreign trade channels of the competing powers. Was foreign direct investment then not about investing in those developing economies, but taking over developing markets?
Yeah, that's one way to say it. It's overtaking their markets. But also, foreign direct investment means that you, a lot of time, multinationals will have their subsidiaries there and do their production there. But actually, FDI is only part of the story, right? The more complicated, the more and that's unseen sometimes, is the arm's length trade. And arm's length trade, so even FDI flow keep increasing, the flow to the developing countries. But what is even more complex is the arm's length trade. In 2010, arm's length contracts generated $2 trillion in sales, and much of it in developing countries. And then, you know, ILO in 2015 published a report saying that one in five jobs within 95 to 2013, one in five jobs worldwide linked to arm's length trade. And while this form of trade is good for the companies, they increase productivity and profitability, they don't have the same good effects on wages. So people who get the jobs because of these investments, right, either direct or through arm's length subcontracting, workers are not the one who benefit from these forms of investments. And so a lot of times, like, the whole country doesn't really benefit, except for maybe, you know, some few people, the elites.
I hate to use the word naturally, but I'm going to anyway. Is capitalism naturally and inevitably always seeking being in a state of monopoly?
I'm not sure if it's naturally, but you can see it in a way that it's different stages, right? Different phases, you can say, of capitalism. But there is a tendency for centralization of capital, and that's what has happened in this era of monopoly capital.
One last question for you, Intan. We've been speaking with sociologist Intan Suwandi, author of the book Value Chains, The New Economic Imperialism, which is absolutely a fantastic work, and all of our listeners should check it out. We want to thank Calvin for turning us on to Intan's work. I've got one last question for you, Intan, and our final question for each and every one of our guests is the question from hell, the question we may hate to ask, you might hate to answer, or our audience is going to hate your response. So what happens if capital and labor had the same mobility? Would that possibly save capitalism?
Globally, you mean?
Exactly.
Right. Save capitalism in what way? Sorry.
From its, inevitable and ultimate demise, right? It's going to be falling from inequality and all of the uncomfortable displeasure is going to put us all through due to the massive inequality that keeps growing. So can we just save all of the problems that are facing capitalism around the world just by giving capital and people the same amount of mobility?
So the answer is, I think, no, because even though maybe, you know, the exploitation will not be as bad, quote unquote, but the same ability of capital and workers won't stop the logic of capitalism itself to accumulate profit. And accumulating profit is never a neutral process. It always involves exploitation and expropriation in various ways. So it may be, the picture may be different than the current, you know, global economy or imperialist global economy, but it won't stop. It won't stop capitalism from being what it is, and will create misery for a majority of people and only benefit a small group of people.
On that happy note, Intan, it has been a real pleasure speaking with you. This really is a fantastic book. And like I said, all of our listeners should pick up a copy as soon as they can. Thank you so much for being on our show this week.
Yes, thank you again for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a This Is Hell interview. For more Interview Hell and to support the show, visit thisishell.com.